This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and the editor of the Indiana Political Insight and the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletters, which are published by the Hannah News Service, and from time to time comes with us to talk about some of the issues that happen not only on the gaming scene here in the Hoosier State, but also at the General Assembly when they're in session, and he's back with us today. Ed, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start first with the article that has recently been, in fact, you can still see online in the Indianapolis Business Journal about the fellow who is the Speaker of the Indiana House, and he has held the seat, I guess, now for the longest time, but he's about to step down. Tell us first about a little more about Brian Bosma for folks up here in this corner of the state that may not know him as well as maybe they might know some other people who have had the job before.
Sure, and the old saw is that during the legislative session, there's no person more powerful than the Speaker of the House of the Indiana House of Representatives, mm-hmm. and that is probably true. There's many a governor over the decades, over the 200-plus years of Indiana statehood who wished that they could have gotten a little bit more done, but it was the Speaker standing in his way, so... But Brian Bosma has held the post for longer than anybody else in state history. And we've also just had a lot of stability in general with our legislative leaders. And we've had a couple of long reigns at the top of the Indiana Senate. And that's really boded well for the legislature. If people get to understand what the process will be, what will be tolerated, what can't be done, accomplished, whatever, what the rules really are, and that they will be consistently applied. And one thing that I think Brian Bosma brought to this job was that he really saw himself as more the Speaker of the House than the Speaker of the Republican Party of the House. And that's an important distinction, Chris, because he really saw his role as being broader than just the party leader in the House. And he left most of the partisan work to his majority floor leaders, and he tried to present kind of a more of an umbrella kind of presence and bring in some of the Democrats and really make sure that it was a participatory process more than what it could have been under a different leader, given the Republican supermajorities in both chambers. And that's a real tribute to Brian Bosma from Indianapolis.
Was Brian, during the time that, of course, he's still in as the House Speaker, but all the years that he's been House Speaker, has he done something differently than maybe his predecessors might have done? Were his predecessors perhaps more politically minded than and tried to operate in that way rather than what Brian Bosma's done?
Well, to a certain extent, I think all you have to do is look at the Speaker who preceded him, Representative Pat Bauer, then Speaker Pat Bauer from South Bend, and one thing that precipitated the Republican supermajority was then Speaker Bauer's kind of unilateral decision to move his caucus literally outside of the state of Indiana to mm-hmm. Champaign, or I guess it was Urbana, Illinois, to protest some anti-labor legislation that Republicans were trying to impose under the new Republican majority. But Speaker Bauer had been that way before, and if you ask Speaker Bosma, who he had the most difficulty in terms of dealing with in his time in the legislature, it would be Pat Bauer. So not everybody is quite as inclusive as Brian Bosma has been. And Bosma, of course, is from Indianapolis, and the Republican who preceded him as Speaker was from Indianapolis. The person who will succeed him as Speaker is from Fishers, but literally on the border of Indianapolis.
You might as well say Indianapolis. Yeah, that's Hamilton County, directly north of Indianapolis,
And the last time that we had a speaker, you saw a speaker from the region was Phil Bainbridge, Democrat, back in the very, very early 1980s. And the speakership has really become a full-time job, and you really have to be able to be in Indianapolis on not necessarily a full-time basis, but you have to be accessible. You have to be able to be there on very short notice. And I'm afraid that, the way that things have kind of grown up in recent years, it's going to be very difficult for us to see anybody else from outside the Indianapolis metro area be speaker again for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, Pat Bauer did it, but you know, there's some complaints that he wasn't around as much as he perhaps might have been needed. And you know, back then, State Road 31, I'm sorry, U.S. 31 was still a road characterized by, you know, a lot of stoplights instead of what we've got today. You know, and it was largely a two-lane road. You know, today is a lot different, thanks to, in part, Pat Bauer, you know, trying to bring that up to essentially interstate standards between 96th Street in Indianapolis and the new bypass in South Bend.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the person who is going to take over as the Speaker of the House in the next General Assembly session in 2021. We're talking about State Representative Todd Houston of Fishers.
Sure. Todd Houston is a product of Hamilton County. He is a proud public school alumnus. He is a Hamilton Southeastern alum and parent of Hamilton Southeastern students. He is an Indiana University graduate, another public institution there. And he however, has kind of led the cause to a certain extent when he worked for Tony Bennett as superintendent of public instruction to make the world a little bit safer for charter schools and private schools as well. Even though he served on the Hamilton Southeastern School Board, that was his first elected position. But he also works professionally in the area of education. He works for the College Board, the folks that do some of the college testing work for students that are leaving high school. And he's very dedicated to to education in general. So I think that's one thing that you need to know about him. In terms of process, Todd Houston is a guy who looks to simply get to yes. He wants to form consensus opinions. He wants to ensure that we can compromise to get to something, just something that's positive, and doesn't let the perfect stand in the way of the good. You know, the perfect is not going to be the enemy of the good under a Houston administration. He is looking to ensure that there are four signatures on a conference committee report, and you know, he sometimes has done that the detriment of you know, some of his own feelings on bills. For example, last year he headed up the work on the omnibus gaming bill, and you know, he had some very strong feelings about the hold harmless provisions that were very important to, for example, Hammond and East Chicago and Michigan City. But he also allowed the will of his caucus, which was for those hold harmless provisions to remain in there, to prevail. And he realized that the hold harmless provisions were essential for the legislation to pass. And so he allowed those to stay in conference in order to get an agreement. But when it came time for the final vote, he surprised even Speaker Bosma by voting against his own bill, because he said he simply, you know, could not countenance the hold harmless provisions in there. He just did not feel philosophically comfortable with that concept. And of course, it wasn't only with respect to Northwest Indiana. It was also applied to Evansville and to French Lick. So it wasn't something that, you know, he was looking at as a sop, for example, to, you know, Democrats in the region. No, that was not at all on his mind. So he's a guy who's very process-oriented and wants to make sure that we can get workable policy and that we can compromise in order to get there. He's a guy who looks for a way to see where we want to be. He's a lot like the governor in this respect, where he wants to look out a number of years, perhaps even decades, and say, okay, this is where we ought to be by X date. What do we need to do to get there? And if somebody, something, some entity, some governmental unit is going to be hurt by this, how can we help them get on a really smooth glide path to kind of ease them through this in order to come up with something that's best for the state as a whole? So he understands the trials and tribulations of local and regional governments as well, and you know, is not going to look for overnight change that's going to necessarily hurt any particular individual entity, governmental institution, company, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense that he's going to be, in a way, very similar in some respects, but in his own right, his own person, than from Speaker Bosma? Are we going to see much of a change? Certainly probably not in the first year, but in subsequent sessions.
Well, I think that you will, but I think that they will also be subtle. And, you know, like I said, he's not a guy who believes in, major overnight change. And, he has a very collegial kind of governing structure or system. With Speaker Bosma, you saw him offer considerable deference to his committee chairs. I think that you will see the same with Speaker Houston. But, there may also be a little bit more thought given to who might be an appropriate committee chair. You may see some changes in, some musical chairs in the 2021 session when he decides, who's perhaps, best in what positions. And, Speaker Bosma, to a certain extent, did some of that. But there's also a little bit of discipline in committee assignments and committee chairmanships as well, even though, once he had people in there, he generally gave them free rein. So it will be interesting to watch how Todd Houston kind of changes things. And something else that I certainly should have mentioned was that when Todd Houston came into the legislature 10 or 12 years ago, he really viewed himself as kind of a potential future fiscal leader. He really was kind of gunning for the chairmanship of the House Committee on Ways and Means.
Right.
And, I mentioned his role in the omnibus gaming legislation, which is probably the most important policy bill in the 2019 session, and certainly the most complicated. But he also, at the same time, was the guy who handled the House end of things with the budget bill, because the Committee on Ways and Means chair, Dr. Tim Brown, was still convalescing from his severe motorcycle accident and, just didn't have the stamina and the ability to kind of step in there and do what the Ways and Means chair would ordinarily do. So Todd Houston kind of took his right hand there and really assumed the lead on that. And if you look at what ended up coming out, and this was also the first full budget for for Senate Committee on Appropriations chair Ryan Mishler from Bremen. If you look at what came out of that process, Todd Houston, who was kind of thrust into it at the last minute, came out with a very House-friendly budget. So, don't underestimate him in terms of understanding what it takes to build a budget and to understand the fiscal minutiae of state government. And one thing that you kept hearing from his colleagues on the gaming bill was that, Todd listened to me. He took into account what I had to say. And listening is a very important part of a leadership role in the General Assembly.
Do you think that is in large part because technically it's a part-time job, that you don't have full-time legislators like some states have, and so they're down there in Indianapolis doing work almost every day or a lot of the days of the week perhaps, and the legislators here are only down basically for special meetings that may come up off and on out of the session. They're only down there for the days that the General Assembly is in session.
Well, that's true, but I think it's maybe even a little bit more basic than that, Chris. You hear the joke about, every one of the 100 U.S. senators looking in the mirror every morning and seeing, the next president. Legislators like to think that they're important even within, you know, their own body, and they want to play a leading kind of role, if not a leadership role, and they want to make sure that, you know, their thoughts are considered in anything that happens. And when the speaker or, you know, any leader listens to you, whether it's a committee chair, you know, the floor leader, whatever, you know, that's something that earns them points in the book of a rank and file legislator.
We just have a couple minutes left here, Ed, to talk about some legislative matters. Let's take up some. Now, there weren't any real bills this session, except maybe for only one that comes immediately to mind that dealt with not only the General Assembly, but with the gaming industry. And I know there was the one bill that has just been voted on, which would in turn help Northwest Indiana, and more specifically the new Hard Rock Casino for Northwest Indiana that's being built right now.
Sure. Yeah, that's a House bill that we thought was just dealing with technical tax matters, but suddenly got amended on second reading thanks to Senator Linda Rogers from Mishawaka to include a provision, a very controversial provision that only passed with the lieutenant governor casting a tie-breaking vote that would allow charter schools at the discretion of public schools to tap into public school referendum money.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, right now, that's the way that it's written. The public schools insist that there wasn't a single school district in the state that asked for this. And, you know, as it's written, it's discretionary. But the charter school folks are just absolutely ecstatic that they seem to have gotten their nose in under the tent. And as we've seen over the past decade or so, you know, things start out with, you know, a small step and then expand. And the public school advocates are concerned, first of all, that in conference, this might get expanded to a mandatory provision instead of a discretionary provision, a shall share rather than a may share kind of provision. And if that happens, then the sponsor of the bill in the Senate, Senator Travis Holdman from Bern, who's the chair of the Senate Committee on Tax and Fiscal Policy, says that he probably would not sign the committee report. Well, you know, that sounds pretty definitive, but, you know, that doesn't mean that the Senate President Pro Tem, Roderick Bray from Martinsville, couldn't replace Senator Holdman if the will of the caucus is that, you know, the charter schools should prevail. So there's a real sense of drama around this particular bill. I think that this may be one of the most watched measures in conference next week. And, you know, even though it's just got one small provision in it that would benefit a very small part of Gary,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's a bigger picture going on here that you need to look at. And the other thing that you need to consider is that Speaker Bosma, who probably won't be speaker by the end of next week. I think he's probably going to officially step down from the rostrum on Monday and hand the gavel to Todd Houston. So he's got a couple of days in the saddle. But, you know, Speaker Bosma is not thrilled with tax bills that are top down, that say from the legislature, that dictates by the legislature to local governments, you know, you shall impose this kind of tax. He's much more in favor of the more permissive kinds of bills that say, okay, the legislature is authorizing the local governing body of X unit to impose this tax at their discretion. And, you know, that way the local folks are the ones that are held accountable for those changes that are made at the local level. So, you know, that's another element that I think is going to be looked at in this particular bill.
Well, we'll just have to watch and see what happens. And if it does make it to the conference committee, then we'll have to follow through on that, too. But Ed, thank you for spending so much time going into great detail to talk about Brian Bosma. He gets glossed over, I know, with just the daily reports that come out of the General Assembly and the little bites of sound that you hear from him talking about whatever may happen to be the topic of that particular report. So it's nice to hear more about Brian Bosma and his length of service as not only the Speaker of the House, but also as a state lawmaker, to be sure. And I hope to have you back on here after we get to the end of the session and kind of give us a little post-mortem here about the measures that they kind of seemingly rushed through here, certainly in the last couple of weeks. They've had a very busy weekend. Well, I guess we'll have one here next week as well, or for as long as they're in session. So thanks for spending some time with us today.
And one other quick note, Chris, based on what you just said, is that, you know, yes, they only have a few days left. There's a lot of potential legislation to cram into just a few bills, because they didn't leave a lot of vehicles open for a lot of the bills that were passed in particular by the Senate that were not even heard in the House. So it's going to be a little bit frantic in terms of trying to find homes for some language.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how things do shape up here. It'll be a very, very busy couple of weeks here, to be sure, as they get things finally wrapped up to where they want to be, I suppose. So Ed, thank you for being with us today to talk about this, and we will catch up with you here as the session finishes up soon.
Well, I would look forward to it, and hopefully by then I'll be done studying for my coronavirus test.
That's right. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator, and he's the editor of the Indiana Political Insight and the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletters that are published by the Hanna News Service. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. John Protopis. He is the senior engineer for the Gas Technology Institute. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
So, John, South Shore Clean Cities is proud to participate in the Michigan and Montana I-94 Clean Fuel Corridor Project with Gas Technology Institute. Tell our listeners what this project is.
Well, the M2M project, it supports an alternative fuels corridor along Interstate 94, beginning at Port Huron, Michigan, and ending at Billings, Montana. The project is funded in part by a $5 million grant from the Department of Energy. The grant began in January 2017 and will end in June of 2021. Alternative fuels corridors are, you know, they're federally designated routes. Mm-hmm. They're on major highways, and they allow for intercity, regional, national travel using lower emissions vehicles. So the network is extensive. It includes over 180 heavily traveled interstates and highways in nearly all 50 states. It covers more than 135,000 miles of national highway system. So we're very interested in having Interstate 94 included in that group.
Sure. So why is the U.S. Department of Energy funding an alternative fuels corridor? Why is that important to U.S. Department of Energy?
Well, they have a very extensive program in their vehicle technology office, and it supports projects that include alternative fuels, include energy efficiency mobility systems and technologies. And their main objective here is twofold: reduce transportation energy costs for businesses and consumers, and of course also reduce emissions from transportation.
So tell our listeners, other than Gas Technology Institute and South Shore Clean Cities, who are the major participants in this project, and what are some of their roles also?
Sure. Well, the Gas Technology Institute is leading the project out of our headquarters in Des Plaines, Illinois. And we're working with coordinators of Clean Cities coalitions along Interstate 94. So this would include Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana. We do need infrastructure providers to support this project, and we've teamed up with Zeph Energy in out of Minnesota, headquarters in Minnesota, to provide the additional electric vehicle fuel, electric vehicle fast charging stations that we need. And then Ozinga Ready Mix out of headquarters in Illinois, they're installing three new compressed natural gas stations, and we do plan to have another compressed natural gas station and one propane station added to the corridor as well. Additionally, we need support from the fleets that will use the fueling stations to provide, you know, some demand that's needed to sustain these facilities. So we've added contract transport services out of headquarters in Wisconsin, Ozinga Ready Mix, headquartered in Illinois, and Viria Trucking out of Wisconsin. They all use compressed natural gas trucks, and it'll frequent these stations that we have along the interstate.
Sure. And I know they pretty much have customer bases along I-94, which is also a great attribute to their commitment to alternative fuels. So can you talk a little bit about what the key deliverables of this project would be, John?
Well, our goal is to, first of all, deploy infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, we've got a target of establishing 14 new electric vehicle fast charging stations. We have three compressed natural gas CNG stations and then one propane station. And as I mentioned, we hope to add one more compressed natural gas station in the near future.
Sure. No, that's wonderful.
So we'll deploy the CNG trucks, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main things we want to do in this project is to launch a dedicated website for the corridor. That website will provide information like case studies and news events and a blog and resources where to find information about the corridor. We do have a roadshow planned in April of 2020 along Interstate 94 where we'll give some opportunity to advertise what we're doing along the corridor. And then the end point, obviously, we want to have this this corridor designated by the Federal Highway Administration as an alternative fuel corridor, and that will involve, you know, putting signage along the route so people are aware of that.
No, it sounds wonderful. Sounds like there's a lot going on. How can our listeners learn more about the alternative fuel corridors and track the progress of this MDEM project, John?
As I mentioned, we are in the process of putting a website together. We haven't named that just at the moment, but mm-hmm. Right now, I guess the best place to come for information is through our office here at Gas Technology Institute, and my contact information I've provided to you if you want to provide
sure.
get that out.
Sure, absolutely.
That would be probably the best way. Once we get this website launched, then anybody that wants information about this project will be able to go to that site and get it.
Well, I know this is a very interesting concept. I think, you know, it's brought on a lot of different opportunities throughout the United States. And, you know, we look forward to, you know, broadcasting more great projects that are going on along the I-94 thoroughfare here. Any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program here, John?
Yeah, I guess the final thing is also one thing that we want to accomplish through this project is we want to produce a template that can be used to deploy more alternative fuel corridors. So by doing this project, involving the team, we will document how this is all being accomplished and what we've learned from it. And so hopefully as others try to follow in our steps and do similar types of activities, they'll have a template to follow.
Well, keep up the great work, John, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to John Protopis, Senior Engineer for the Gas Technology Institute. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. Remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. The Porter County Substance Abuse Council has been very, very busy over recent years in trying to get to the community of Porter County and all the sources that they have available and provide the support that public and private nonprofit agencies need to help prevent and to reduce the issue of substance abuse in Porter County. And Carly Samaiola is with the Porter County Substance Abuse Council to talk about the council and also, too, about a very interesting podcast that started out locally, but it's getting some national attention. Carly, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, take a few moments and tell us more about what the Porter County Substance Abuse Council is all about and the services that the council provides in Porter County these days.
Okay, so what we do is we have grants, and we take those grants and we put different programs throughout the community. So right now we have three grants that we coordinate. I coordinate the Partnerships for Success grant, and that entails doing some opioid education in the schools, giving youth the ability to do a program called Real Media, which tells them how to determine if ads are targeted towards them for different kinds of products. We take a primary focus, of course, on like alcohol, tobacco. So to educate them how to be kind of a bit more mindful if that is being targeted towards them. We also, with my program, I have a thing called Take Back Day. That's a DEA program. So we have drop boxes within the county where people can take back their prescription medications. They are at all of our police stations, and they actually are open all year round. The DEA has two main days, one in April and one in October, that they emphasize and ask people to drop their medications then into those drop boxes, but they're available all year round, so it's pretty awesome. And we know, just based on information that we gather, that prescription medications being left in the home give a higher risk for somebody to misuse them. So, of course, getting rid of them in a safe way is really helpful. My program also has a positive ticket program, which is in the schools, where we provide tickets and reward cards to students through the staff there at the school. So if the staff sees a student doing something really great, they give them a reward card and this positive ticket that basically says, good job, you're doing awesome. We noticed that you did this thing that was really good.
I know that you and your colleagues also are involved in a lot of other programs there within the council as well, but do you find that the drop-off boxes are probably at least the most visible and maybe it seems most successful?
You know, I think that it is a very visible thing because they're in the community. You know, people can see them. If you're at the police station, they're usually like right there in the lobby, so you walk in and you're going to see it. We definitely think it's a successful program. We recently started a harm reduction committee that kind of partners with that Take Back Day program, where we have 8 law enforcement agencies in Porter County who have agreed to partner the Take Back prescription drop box with a Sharps cabinet collection. So it's great because what somebody can do is they're going to take their prescriptions and then say they are insulin dependent or they have some kind of medication where they have to administer their medication through a needle, they can then drop that needle off in a safe location at the police station as well. Mm-hmm. And that's monitored anytime the police station is open, 24 hours of monitoring. So,
well, it sounds like it's a good way to deal with the issues. And we know that Porter County has had a very serious substance abuse problem for a number of years. And I know one of the biggest advocates of finding ways to help deal with the problem, aside from the Porter County Sheriff's Department, has been a fellow who unfortunately gets to see the very sad ending on some of these cases. And that's the former Porter County Coroner, Chuck Harris. And Chuck is, I know, the chairman of your board there at the agency. And have you found that the support from him and other Porter County officials are making it easier to not only advance these particular initiatives that you're supporting, but also to get the word out about them?
Oh, absolutely. So anytime that we have somebody who is a Porter County official, it definitely helps bring light to what we're doing. And Chuck has really just gone above and beyond to help us. I know that he is encouraging the community to check out our podcast. He is on our board. He does presentations, and he's very active in our coalition. So having him backing us and giving his support to us has really just been beneficial, not only to us, but to the people of the community, because if they know about us, then we can provide services as well.
One of the things, aside from the support that you have and the programs, including yours, and I know the Drug-Free Communities program that is underway in Porter County, is a way to get the word out by podcast. And the podcast is very interesting in its own right. It's a way to be very visible and talk about the issues and not pull any punches, I would imagine. The podcast, by the way, is entitled Matters of Substance. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about how it got started, and it's picked up, like I said, some national recognition here not recently.
Yeah, so we were realizing that a lot of times we were going to health fairs and different events where we would hand out brochures, information. And while that's not necessarily a bad method of giving information out, and there is a time and place for that, we kind of realized that it would be a bit more helpful to also have this on like a digital platform, because a lot of people get their information now from hopping online, going to Google, listening to podcasts, you know, checking out different formats like that. So we thought it would be beneficial to create a podcast so we could just get information out that we have. You know, we collect a lot of data, and so we know a lot of things that other people don't necessarily have access to or don't think about looking up. So as we collect that data, we're able to inform the public, here's what's going on, here's what we're seeing in Porter County. And it all kind of just started with realizing we wanted to have another way to reach people. This creates a format that doesn't have a lot of barriers. We have the podcast on all kinds of on a lot of platforms. So we have Spotify, iHeartRadio. A person can check it out by going to our Facebook page, Twitter. So we have a lot of ways that we can connect to it. So it takes down those barriers of having to be in person to give the information out.
Have you got any response from anybody since the podcast has been out there and expanded to the different platforms?
We've gotten some really good, we use Libsyn, which is a platform that kind of monitors where we're reaching. And so we have reached, we're most heavily listened to in Indiana. Our second top is Illinois, and then we also are reaching California, which is pretty interesting. So yeah, we've kind of expanded across the whole country, and so we're reaching a lot of people. We also have a few listeners in Australia as well, which was pretty cool to learn. So we've gotten some good feedback, you know, just general like Facebook stuff, people commenting on what they're listening to, thinking it's great information, and they're really enjoying listening to it. So yeah, so far it's a great success for us.
Now, I know that the platforms that you put the podcast out on are involving with other programs as well, too, over a number of different opportunities. Are none of these related? That is, they may deal with substance abuse problems or education or prevention?
So we have the platforms that we are utilizing are mostly social media right now, yeah. And I think that what is beneficial about that is obviously if you're on social media, you have the ability to reach all kinds of people. So we are being able to connect with larger organizations that we didn't necessarily know about, or we might be able to reach a smaller new non-for-profit or even just a cause. Somebody's out there doing something good because they were personally affected by substance use disorder. So we're being able to kind of reach a much broader net of people that we can connect to and then utilize. Ideally, what we're looking to do soon is expand with the podcast of being able to take in call-in guests. So we would be able to get people from across the country who maybe have written a book or someone who is a specialist in their community, and we would be able to utilize them through the call-in function and use their information to distribute to everybody that listens.
Well, it sounds very interesting, yeah, and especially to be able to branch out like that. Now, the topics obviously are very much key to substance abuse, but are there any other related topics that maybe will come up as podcast topics in the future?
Yeah, so like you said, of course, substance use disorder is like is our main focus, but we try to be relevant with what's currently going on. So this week we actually recorded some information that we were able to take from the CDC and about the coronavirus. So we're going to be launching that here in the next day or so. So we're going to be able to kind of take information that we know is solid, like here's what the CDC says on how to respond to this issue, and we're going to distribute it to on a much broader level than, you know, being able to just share it on Facebook. So, yeah, I think we're going to be approaching all kinds of different topics. Hopefully, the things that we're seeing are big that are rising, like coronavirus we're going to discuss, and then things like that that are trending. And, of course, our primary focus, though, is going to be that substance use disorder.
Well, Carly, thank you for spending time with us to talk not only about the Porter County Substance Abuse Council, about the issues involving substance abuse here in Northwest Indiana, but also about the podcast, again, entitled Matters of Substance. And you can check with whatever platform you get podcasts and look it up and listen to it and find out more about it. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Carly Samayoa. Samayoa is the representative from the Porter County Substance Abuse Council. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Lake County and Gary City local boards for emergency food and shelter programs are making available to organizations here in Northwest Indiana a chance to be able to help continue providing humanitarian aid to migrants around the region. It's all coming from not only the organizations that are helping supply the support, but also from the Lake Area United Way. And Andrea Pru-Benicki is with the Lake Area United Way. She's the Vice President for Community Impact. And Andrea, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking to talk about this today.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the issues. I think maybe people realize that maybe they don't realize about the issues of aid to immigrants here in Northwest Indiana. How serious is the issue?
Well, that's a great question, Chris. And I know that from speaking anecdotally with a couple of different organizations, that there are nonprofits in Lake County in Northwest Indiana who are working with migrants who have been released from the Department of Homeland Security, and they are simply awaiting for the go-ahead to get to work in our community. And so the Emergency Food and Shelter Program, which is actually federally funded, it is not a local funding source, it's a federally funded source, is offering an opportunity for any nonprofit, faith-based, or governmental agency that is working with migrants from the southern border, providing that humanitarian aid, the food, the shelter, the transportation, and health and medical services. They're offering the opportunity for those organizations to apply for funding to reimburse the expenses associated with that service.
When you have to approach agencies, of course, a lot of them I know are working, of course, with the Lake Area United Way right now because of the initiative that the Lake Area United Way has to try to reach out in particular to families as well as individuals that fit into the income bracket and wanted to help get them supported as well as help make their lives better by improving them, their education, their employment, and the like. How do the social service agencies that you all work with on this particular project help deal with these people who are in particular are not from this particular region? They may be from the southern part of the border around in Mexico or other Latin American countries.
Well, I think that there are so many nonprofits in Northwest Indiana that are helping people that are in poverty, that are one step above poverty, our Alice families, and that are working with people who have various immigration statuses. And so I want to be clear that the funding opportunity that I wanted to talk with you about today, Chris, is a federal opportunity for these agencies to be reimbursed. And United Way, in this instance, is really a facilitator for this grant process. And so this is not United Way funding. This is funding that we facilitate coming from the federal government into Lake County. And so any nonprofit or faith-based or governmental agency can apply for this competitive grant from the federal government. And to do that, what they would need to do is go to the Emergency Food and Shelter Program website. And I'm going to say it slowly, and then hopefully you'll remind me to say it a second time at the end of our call today, Chris. It is the website that these nonprofits, faith-based organizations, or governmental agencies need to go to is EFSP, so that's E as in easy, F as in Frank, S as in sugar, P as in Peter, EFSP.unitedway.org. And when the organizations get to the website, right in the middle of the page is a yellow tab that says supplemental funding information. And on that site is all the information that a nonprofit or faith-based or governmental agency might need in order to make an application for these federal funds, reimbursing their emergency services for any migrants that they might be working with in the community. Our job as United Way is to facilitate the local board for the Emergency Food and Shelter Program. And so this local board is made up of representatives from Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, the Continuum of Care, the Lake County Prosecutor's Office. And we as United Way are facilitating that discussion. When agencies apply for this federal funding, Chris, they need to do so by March 16th at 10:59 p.m. And the application is online. And from that point, when they hit submit, our local board will review to confirm that it's an eligible organization and then submit that to the national board. The national board is then going to make decisions about how to disperse this funding for humanitarian aid for migrants who came from the southern border. They have $25 million that they are dispersing along the border, but they have an additional $5 million to help nonprofits, faith-based organizations, and governmental agencies who are serving outside of that southern border. And I do know that there are a few agencies up here in Northwest Indiana that work specifically to help people with that are immigrating into our community. These are folks that want to be here, that want to work and want to contribute to our community. And so they're helping and providing that food and shelter, transportation and medical services in order to keep folks healthy while they're awaiting that go-ahead to work.
Well, Andrea, thank you for spending time with explaining what the programs are all about and the support that is going out to migrants here in Northwest Indiana. And more information is on the Lake Area United Way website, I know, to be able to apply for these, follow the rules and regulations and all. And I hope that you have many more organizations, maybe new ones, that not only are continuing to support migrants in the region, but some new organizations that are willing to give it a try, too. Thanks very much for explaining things for us today.
All right. It's my pleasure, Chris.
Andrea Prue Bonicki is the Vice President for Community Impact for the Lake Area United Way. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.